This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
When you're new, you know, you have that window of opportunity where people don't expect you to know anything. So take advantage of that by asking all questions and you know, trying to really soak up. No question is a foolish question, and that will help you get you up to speed, get you up the learning curve much more quickly.
On any given day in Washington, D.C., policy proposals are created, debated, and decimated by tens of thousands of people and organizations working behind the scenes. Each week, a guest and I will visit one of D.C.'s many watering holes and distill the art of advocacy. We'll pull back the curtain a bit and take a look at how they play their part in this sausage factory we call our federal government. So if you're at all interested in how the sausage is made, pull up a chair, grab a drink, and join us for the next 20 minutes or so. After all, what goes better with sausage than a tall, cold one? Welcome to this episode of 80 Proof Politics. I'm your host, Bill Shute. Today, we're broadcasting from Chennai in Arlington, Virginia. It's at 1301 South Joyce. It's in the Pentagon Row shopping plaza. It's a wonderful, authentic Irish pub, a sort of classic pub fare. They've got half price appetizers during happy hour, half-price burgers on Monday. And in the summer, they do a concert series, which is just fabulous. I highly recommend coming to listen to some great music of all types on their summer evenings. But it's a great place to come in the winter as well, because there's a fire pit outside right next to an ice skating rink. So it's a great place to come have a hot toddy, enjoy the cool winters in Arlington, Virginia. And if you want to host a private event, they've got great capacity to host anything from a group of 25 to a group of 200. So they are built for your entertaining needs. And we're here today with Mark Bear, founder of Bear Strategic Consulting. So welcome, Mark, and cheers.
Cheers. Thanks, Bill. Thanks for having me here.
Well, glad you could be on the show. You know, I was looking at your website where you were talking about Bear Strategic Consulting, and you use a phrase that I have not seen before, and I think it's I'm curious if it's a differentiator for you in what you provide to your clients. You say that Bear Strategic Consulting is an advocacy and training firm. Explain what you mean by that.
I work with primarily scientists and engineers, other technical folks, who are trying to clearly explain the value of their work to their most important stakeholders. So that's policymakers, could be investors, the public, other funders, and really translating what can be complex topics into engaging, memorable, jargon-free language, you know, which really resonates and is relatable. And so the training is in what I sort of learned on the Hill 20-plus years. How do you take a complicated policy issue, topic, could be a nuclear reactor that produces tritium, plutonium, and has environmental waste, and describe that in a 30-second soundbite for CNN or to a reporter from the New York Times, you know, who's on deadline.
Boy, I've got to tell you, I spent the last 18 years advocating university science and trying to get the researchers in front of policymakers and program managers, mm-hmm. and it always started with, okay, you need to take it down a level so that I can understand it and explain it to someone who I probably going to need to take it another level down. That is
exactly.
Such a critical skill.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Bill. And it's, you know, and it is a skill, and that's where sort of this starts. It's a skill, which means that it can be learned, and with practice, it can be perfected to a degree. And you don't have to be a spokesperson or someone like me who is talking, you know, all the time for a living. You know, you can be steeped in technology or, you know, spend a lot of time in the lab. But it starts sort of with the mindset that this is something that's important. and that I should learn this, and then where can I go to learn and get better at it? And so I go around. I was actually in New Zealand a couple weeks ago talking to environmental engineers at a big conference there. I did a keynote. I'm heading to University of Chicago. I've worked with Cornell University, University Arizona State, a whole range of universities, plus scientific societies, whose members, I think what's really whose members are interested in getting involved in policymaking on one level or another. So I think really after this sort of wave was occurring, but I think after the last presidential election in 2016, you know, a lot of scientists started to realize that they were in the crosshairs and their views, based on evidence and fact, were being dismissed or at least downgraded, sometimes denigrated, and they weren't even in the room anymore. And that's scary, I think, for all of us to think that the major decisions about, you know, public investments are being made not data-based, not evidence-based.
Well, I remember feeling the same way when sequestration kicked in. You know, there were a lot of great scientific programs that all of a sudden were on the chopping block.
Yeah, for sure, right. And so scientists historically have shied away from getting involved for a variety of reasons, and there are a lot of different reasons. And I think as a political hack that I am, I think it is fascinating to look at the power relationships and the rationale and always ask why. Why is that? And so, but that's a whole other topic. But nonetheless, I really enjoy, through my online course, through workshops that I do, through keynote speeches that I give, one-on-one executive coaching that I do, because this is really important stuff. And as you know, you were right in the middle of it. And I'm kind of in that translator role a lot of times. And your job would have been a lot easier if maybe that researcher, that tenured professor, had some training before she or he came to Washington to talk to you and then go up to the Hill or something like
that. Boy, that is so true. We used to always do a briefing session in the front side and then a debrief on the back side and kind of dissect how it went to help them professionally so they can get better at it next time. And it seems like you have a very dedicated approach to that. I mean, you have something called the Savvy Scientist Training Series.
Right.
Tell me about that.
Right. Well, you know, when I say savvy, I mean sort of aware of how the world really operates beyond your circle. Be aware of how the environment that you are going to be thrust into or that you're going to enter into, the policymaking environment, has its own culture and kind of set of, you know, own language, own culture, own way of doing things. And you know, it starts again with that recognition. And then the savvy scientist says, okay, it's different from what I'm used to. I want to learn about this strange world inside of the Beltway, or could be at your local council meeting, your county board meeting, or, you know, all that sort of, you know, kind of, I'll put that in one category. It doesn't have to be in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, it's a skill set.
It's a skill set, right, sure. And so once you sort of have that recognition and you decide I'm going to start to work on it, then, you know, you get savvier. And I guess the bottom line I would sort of put on this as far as how I consider what I mean by savvy scientists is, you know, understanding there's often a formal process to getting something done. We understand that. If you're going to, you know, submit a grant and, you know, you have to follow these steps and there are these deadlines and so forth. And you need to know what those are and you need to follow those. But when humans are involved, there's always an informal process.
Yeah.
And oftentimes that is relationship driven. And it could, you know, it could be more intangible. You know, who got a grant funded by that agency before? What were they looking for? You know, kind of trying to figure out that. And that's really, for me, the essence of savvy, is understanding that just checking boxes, you know, that are required, that's necessary, but it's not sufficient.
Yeah, so it's not only learning the skills to be engaged in the process at an appropriate and effective level, but now you're throwing in some strategy as well.
Exactly,
there.
Yeah.
And strategic communications is part of what I know your firm does. I was listening to, well, and you have a highly popular podcast as well,
nice.
When Science Speaks, that I think I highly recommend to this audience as well, because it touches on similar topics, but focused on a very important niche that you've been talking about here, and that's explaining science to people who make the decisions on funding science, right?
Exactly.
I was listening to one of the episodes recently, I think it was your episode with Karen Richards, And she, I think, raised an issue that you've just started talking about as well right here, and that's communications requires a connection as well. Explain what you two were talking about in that regard.
Sure. Well, I like to say you need to connect before you communicate. And then the question is, well, what does connect really mean? And it boils down to finding common ground, similarities, finding shared values, shared experiences. You know, humans, and there's a great book that I'm actually reading right now, which I would highly recommend. It's called Social, and it's written by Matthew Lieberman, and he talks about how humans, since the very beginning, you know, we're wired to seek connection. And at one point, that was a matter of survival. You know, you didn't want to be ostracized. You didn't want to be sent out into exile, you know, from the tribe, from the community, and out into the wilderness, because you weren't going to last very long out on your own. So, you know, through evolution, you know, we natural selection, I suppose, we value connections and we seek connections all the time. So when you're engaging on an issue, whether it's funding for NIH, for example, you know, you also have to think about, well, you know, the audience or the listener or the decision maker, you know, what sort of connection do I have or does our organization have to that individual, to the decider? And, you know, like I said, a lot of it has to do with similarity. And people tend to, and there's research by Robert Cialdini, who's one of my favorites on persuasion, research about, you know, people tend to like those who are similar to themselves. And I call it reflection, affection, connection. You know, they see themselves in you or your organization. They like what they see, not a surprise, because they're sort of looking back at themselves or relating to themselves. And then that is a firm basis of connection, which helps you then decide, how am I going to craft my message when I talk to this person? And I guess the last thing I would say on it is that it has to be authentic. It has to be honest, and there has to be a genuineness to it.
Could not agree more.
And what I tell, you know, groups or teams is, if you yourself aren't able to do that, say, with your decider, with integrity or with honesty, with authenticity, then you need to find someone else who can. And that could be someone else on your team. It could be a consultant that you bring on, you know, but you really need to think about that and then ask yourself, am I the right person to engage given this need for connection?
So how did you get started on this? I mean, how did you discover this niche and your ability to deal with it?
Well, it's a great question. And it was like a lot of things. I didn't start out knowing this is what I wanted to do. I guess if I take a step back and look at it really from the origins, it starts with a real respect, admiration for scientists and AAAS fellows, you know, the American Association for Advancement of Science. It's the oldest and largest international scientific organization. I worked with them. I trained all their science fellows actually last year, who are in Congress and the executive branch last year. And I had worked with these scientists in the it was the gamut. We had a veterinarian, we had a psychologist, we had physicists, we had all, and you know, they were here for a year in our office, and they were going to immerse themselves in policy and try to learn some lessons on how to move issues forward. And so after I left Congress, I retired, I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do, and it was right around the election time that people in 16 after the election, people started contacting me and saying, well, what should we do? We need to, you know, we're outraged.
Mm-hmm.
and so I wrote a blog post called, you know, how to deal with PTSD, which was President Trump's stress disorder. and it really boiled down to advocacy. Like, if you want to make a change, you've got to make your voice heard. And here are some ways that you might want to consider doing that. March for Science then, of course, ramped up. They had over 1 million people worldwide. They had about 100,000 marching in D.C. Yep. And that was really the beginning of me sort of thinking about working with scientists, because scientists were going to realize that they needed to be engaged now in the policymaking process. But it was clear, at least it was clear to me, that they had absolutely no idea what they were doing. Just like I would have absolutely no idea what I was doing in a chemistry lab. Yeah, and then just the last kind of piece of it was, I just got interested. I'm fascinated.
I think you call yourself a persuasion nerd.
Yeah, persuasion nerd, absolutely. self-admitted and proud of it, because I'm just fascinated by what moves people to action, to do things, to take up particular positions and advocate for them. And so when this term alternative facts came out in January, right after the inauguration in 2017, I started looking at it, just kind of interested in, you know, how is this happening? And then as that became kind of part of the sort of strategy from a lot of high levels, I started thinking, well, how do you combat it? How do you push back? A lot of people were talking at the time about what it was. Well, I wasn't really. I mean, I think we all kind of agreed it were lies. You can put them in, you know, you can put any kind of qualifier on that you want. But I wasn't really interested in that as much as how do you push back. And so I wrote some pieces. I was fortunate enough. The New Yorker published a letter that I wrote, and I was. And then I spoke at AAAS at the conference, the annual conference, which happened to be in Austin, Texas. And I did a talk on, you know, alternative facts and fake news, how to stand up for science when data aren't enough. And it was packed. I was really surprised, actually, that they were that. And that's when I realized that I should have kind of something that I should have known all along, which is that facts and evidence are the oxygen that scientists, you know, have. And without that, they really, their whole enterprise just kind of collapses if you take that away and say it's no longer important. And that's when I realized that I should be helping scientists get their voice heard, because we both kind of share, and I felt this affinity with scientists, even though I'm clearly not one myself, but kind of like I got into politics to try to make a difference, solve problems, and I really felt that scientists got into science for the same reason.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Yeah, you mentioned that you got into politics. You had a very lengthy career on Capitol Hill. Tell us a bit about what you did over those years.
Well, I just feel so fortunate to have had the experience that I did working for an amazing boss, Ed Markey, who is now Senator Ed Markey. He was Representative Ed Markey and Senator Ed Markey when I worked for him. But I started at the bottom. I was an intern. I was an unpaid intern.
During college?
After graduation from college.
Oh, wow.
Which was adding a little salt to the wound, as my friends were all in med school and various law schools and all this stuff, and I'm working for free answering phones. But it was the right thing to do. And, you know, I was fortunate, actually, because my sister was living in Silver Spring, so I could sleep on the couch there, and I didn't have to worry about expenses as much as I would have otherwise. And then I got hired. It was 8 months. It was probably the longest 8 months of my life. But I did get hired I went up from staff assistant to legislative correspondent. And then it wasn't too much longer that I moved into a strictly legislative role. And one of my jobs actually was, and it kind of relates, I think, maybe to what we're talking about here as far as distilling a topic, boiling down a topic to its essence very quickly, is I was a floor monitor. So in the Markey office, that meant that whenever the House was in session, you were watching the proceedings, and you had to know, you had to make vote recommendations to the boss as he was out and at hearings and he was in meetings. And, you know, you had to be able to explain what the issue was in very short order.
That was that limited to certain issues you were responsible for, or was this a jack of all trades?
It was all issues, every issue. If it was talked about on the House floor, you needed to know about it.
What a great education.
Yeah, it was. And so, you know, just imagine, you know, running with a boss, you know, down the corridors of the Rayburn Building and the basement of Rayburn Building to the subway and explaining what this vote is and who's for it and who's against it and why is that. And, you know, so it kind of got me thinking in different dimensions, which is something that I teach, and it kind of goes to something I mentioned earlier, Bill, is that, you know, we've got your facts, necessary but not sufficient. So what are the other dimensions that you need to think in? And over the years, I kind of developed the model, which is really the savvy scientist system that I teach, in looking at any policy issue and really trying to zoom in on the most important stuff very quickly.
Yeah, that is a real talent. And it's hard to get that from a textbook. I mean, you have to be on the ground, very practical learning experience to get that. So after, what, 20 years, Capitol Hill?
It was 20 years and two tours, I like to say, because I left after about 4 years just because I felt I should go to grad school. Maybe that was, you can argue one way or another whether it was worth it. I felt that it was. I left. I went to the Kennedy School of Government, which actually brought me back to Massachusetts, which I loved. And my plan was to stay up in Massachusetts and live in the south end of Boston. And, you know, I had my whole, you know, I was going to live in one of those brownstones. I had the whole thing picked out, except that there wasn't really that much opportunity for me in Boston, which is, I love Boston. It's also, you know, it's more of a focused city. I wasn't going to work in the medical field. I wasn't going to law. You know, I obviously didn't go to law school. I wasn't in finance, and I wasn't really that interested in education writ large, education policy, I should say. And so I ended up coming back to D.C. and working for PricewaterhouseCoopers, which I liked a lot, doing management consulting. Okay. I went to a startup, which basically allowed me to live the cliche with the foosball and the couch and the free food.
A high-tech startup.
Yeah, and they had real clients. I could also walk to work still from my office. And then the call came from the Markey office after 9/11. Saying, look, you know, there's a lot going on here, obviously, and Senator Markey, who was congressman at that point, had been appointed to the House Select Committee on Homeland Security. It wasn't
brand
a permanent
new
committee.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's a whole, talk about a good political case study on how that was stood up, because other chairmen and chairwomen don't like when their jurisdiction gets gets maybe whittled here or there to make room for another committee.
Yeah, so what you're referring to is when the Homeland Security Department was set up and then the committee was established as well, there was just a merger of jurisdictions and responsibilities from other existing areas.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, the committee was set up to be, as you point out, to be oversight of this huge new department. I think March 1, 2003 was when the Homeland Security Department was actually opened its doors, although the Transportation Security Administration preceded that just
right.
A little bit. So in any case, I spent the next 5 years working on Homeland Security issues. Primarily aviation security was my number one responsibility. We worked on a major change in the law related to air cargo security. Billions of pounds of air cargo carried in the belly of passenger aircraft every year, and none of it was being screened for explosives. It was the ultimate out of sight, out of mind. After all of these billions of dollars being spent on passenger security and check bag security and carry on bag security, the process for air cargo security, very, very limited. And actually, we waged a 5-year campaign to require the same level of screening for cargo as passengers' check bags.
I'm sure glad I didn't know that at the time.
Yeah, it was a huge loophole. It took us 5 years because the administration was against it, the Bush administration was against it, the airlines were against it, the freight forwarders were against it. We were gonna destroy the international global economy as we know it if we made this change. And so we heard every kind of argument under the sun, but after a lot of blood, sweat, and tears, President Bush signed it, and it is now the law. Thanks to a lot of hard work from the flight attendants, from the airline pilots, from the families of 9/11, from people who lost family members as a result of the attacks, it was an amazing thing, and we got it done.
True coalition building.
Yep, for sure. Yep.
Well, you mentioned that you're in part of the interim, not only between Markey jobs, you went to grad school, but then you worked at Price Waterhouse at PwC. Mm-hmm. What did you do there?
Sure, that was a great education in and of itself to be at Price Waterhouse Coopers. Because at that point in time, so I was in D.C., as I mentioned. At that point in time, it was a new mayor, Tony Williams, and he had been elected on a mandate to really get the trains running on time, so to speak, in D.C. You know, there's so much frustration. And so if you think about all city departments and agencies and getting them to run better, you might think that maybe the number one place, again, this was back in 2000, I have to say.
Back in the day.
Yeah, way back in the day. The number one place that everybody has to go and was a complete disaster, not just in D.C., all across the country, was the Department of Motor Vehicles.
Oh.
And people would take off a day from work, and they would, you know, bring a lunch, you know, dinner, a snack, midnight snack with them. I mean, it was like a quite an endeavor. And so I was fortunate, actually, and I'll explain why I felt like I was lucky, to be on a relatively small team that went in there. And, you know, their initial hope, as far as the administrators, they're bringing a new director for the Department of Motor Vehicles. Cheryl Hobbs Newman was her name. She was great, a lot of energy, smart woman. But they basically just wanted to get off the front page.
Oh, yeah.
And I can just say, you know, they weren't on the front page for a flattering reason. I mean, there were employees who had been selling driver's license, which is a federal offense. So there were FBI stings. They had, you know, all sorts of stuff like that. And, of course, the technology, everything was broken. The process, the technology, the physical buildings were crumbling. And so we went in there, and thanks to, you know, the trust that we built up with the employees, many of whom had been there a long time and were frankly fed up with the way things were operating. And we just took the whole place apart. And then working with, you know, side by side with the employees, we put it all back together. I mean, you know, not exactly, of course, we updated it, we changed the policies, we streamlined things. The employees were great providing their insights into what would be better.
Because I'm sure there was some reluctance on the front end of that from the employee standpoint.
Absolutely. I mean, I think initially there was skepticism because there had been other consultants in there and there was never any change. And then it became, you know, these people, you know, so these people are just going to come in, they're going to write a report telling us how terrible we are, mm-hmm. and they're going to leave. And, you know, but we, you know, we had various kind of ways of demonstrating that that wasn't going to happen, that we, you know, we weren't, that wasn't going to be a successful project from our standpoint. And so, you know, it was just wonderful I would facilitate a lot of these stakeholder meetings and really talk to employees about what their hopes were for the organization and their ideas about how we could make it better. And it was just funny because, oh, and I should just say, I also came up with a new tagline for them that they still use. I check the website every once in a while. When somebody says something about the DMV, I'm like, I wonder if they still use. So if you think about back in 2000, 2001, when websites were actually moving from just being brochures to portals to do transactions.
Right.
And so one of the major themes was, look, if there are huge long lines, some of those people are waiting in line for a license renewal or something of that nature that now we have the functionality to do online. If we can keep those people, that cohort, out of the building, then guess what? They're not waiting in line. And then we had a way also of automating so that there were even specific lines within the queue that were just for these like quick transactions.
Yeah,
so if
right.
we couldn't keep them out of the building, if they didn't have access or they didn't know about it. So I said, look, DMV, DC DMV, skip the trip. And it was not that was such a genius turn of phrase, but it was really like something that people could remember, right? Which is always part of what you're aiming for. And we want you to skip the trip. I mean, you know, here are all the things you can do from the comfort of your home, or before laptops really use that much, but from anywhere, you know, you can get a connection and a secure connection. And so it was just great working with that team there. And literally last week on Facebook, a friend said something about, you know, I was just over at the DC DMV inspection station on Half Street. And I remember the opening of that because I sort of did communication and press for the very opening of that. And we had a Fox reporter who was there. But he said, you know, just over at the inspection station. And it was such a pleasure.
Oh,
it was so
God.
Easy. It was great. And then I had to comment, you know, and just say, oh, I'll tell you a little story about that. You know, Mr. Fred Loney was the head of it. And he was an Air Force guy. And he was so committed and just a great example of what a public servant should aspire to. Yeah, really, really amazing. So dedicated. And there were a lot of those people within the organization, which is why the program ultimately was a success.
Yeah. And so how long was that project?
You know, it was less than a year. It was like an 8-month project, and that included, you know, putting in this what's called a Q-matic at the time. It's a brand name, I think. And And that kind of technology spread all across the country. But it's kind of a way of, it's a line, electronic line ordering system, but it's also a way of directing certain more complicated transactions to certain employees or lines, and then the easier ones to other ones. So you try to really be as efficient as possible, you know, based on what you first arrive, like when you first arrive at the DMV. It's like this in Virginia too, which is where I'm living now. You know, you basically just want to tell them what you need done, and then they can give the number that they give you kind of corresponds to the complexity of your request, your transaction.
So that explains two things about my DMV experiences. Why they ask your need, mm-hmm. when you have to check the box, fill in the form when you mm-hmm. first show up, and why the numbering is so apparently random.
Exactly. It's not a bakery.
Yeah. I was like, wait a minute, I'm 73, and they just called 112. Yeah. What did I fall asleep?
Three, and then they're all over the place. So, but now you'll hear that and be like, very good, the system's working.
Now we know, Q-matic.
Very
good. It's about Q-matic. How long were you with PwC?
For about 2 years. Okay. And then the project manager on my PwC team recruited me to go to this internet company because he was leaving to go. And I went with him for about a year and a half or so, and then got the bat sign from the marquee operation. And then I went back for about 15 years back to work for Ed Markey, and that of course included two Senate campaigns, because when President Obama appointed John Kerry Secretary of State, opening up that Senate seat, Ed ran for it, and because you had to run for the unexpired term,
sure.
which was 18 months
in
the special,
yeah.
and then you won that, which he did. Then you had to run again for the full term a year and a half later, and I was there for both of those.
So, Mark, you leave Markey's office the second time. Do you start the firm right after that? Did you come up with your own firm right after leaving Markey's?
No, actually, I wasn't 100% sure what I wanted to do.
That's not uncommon.
After that point, you know, I mean, I again felt really lucky to have had the experience, and I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, how I wanted to make an impact later, and then gradually through some, you know, string of events that I couldn't necessarily foresee, I started deciding that it was really time to help scientists, engineers, other technical people. You know, after the election, the presidential in 2016, those folks were really feeling like their expertise didn't matter anymore.
Yeah.
And that the science and the evidence and the data that was all built in good faith and after a lot of experimentation and peer review and all those sorts of things, well, that just didn't matter if someone saw an article somewhere on the internet saying the opposite. And that has huge implications, negative implications, I would suggest, for all of us. We want decisions, big decisions, which are usually left up to government to make. We want those decisions to be based on the best available information possible, not on self-interest or anecdote, or falsehoods. So I actually started writing about alternative facts. You know, we talked about that. And then I realized that scientists were sort of comrades in arms with me in this whole thing of how to combat alternative facts, because facts are what they have. You know, that's their currency. So I started working with AAAS and the March for Science, and then I've worked, I guess basically what I do is using my online course, which is called How to Communicate Your Science Effectively to Any Audience. Also workshops, which are usually half-day workshops, one-on-one coaching, and then presentations, keynotes, and so forth, and guest lectures. You know, I teach the various, what I call sort of like, as you brought up, Bill, like the training part is really this kind of insider strategy approach that I developed, you know, over 20 years or so, on really how to present, how to distill, how to figure out what's going to really be relatable, how to do that in short order. I have the good fortune, I'm heading back to my alma mater, Cornell, to do another guest lecture. I've done it for 5 years now, and every time I go up there, more people are interested in science policy, more scientists interested, want to get involved. And I guess the message that I would have to them is, we need you. We need your energy. We need your expertise. We need your voice in the policymaking arena. So
you're teaching to scientists, engineers, the poli-science?
Yeah. Welcome everybody, of course. But the class happens to be in the mining school of biomedical engineering on campus at Cornell, and Professor Chris Schaefer is the professor of that course, who coincidentally had been a AAAS science fellow in the Markey office back in the day, which of course is how we met. And then Chris went back, he got tenure track, and created this course, and then asked me if I'd guest lecture, and that's been about 5 years ago. And I guess one thing I'll mention about his course, which kind of ties into what you're saying about poli-sci, Bill, and you've been on the ground and you've been in these rooms where it happens, so to speak, you know, and you know how it really works. And that's so important as a practitioner to share that information, go beyond just, you know, the textbook, so to speak. One thing that Chris does as a way to do that is each of the his whole class, the Science Policy Bootcamp course, is divided up into small groups, and they work together on a real policy problem. So this can range from encouraging composting in Ithaca, New York, which is where Cornell is located. It can be trying to eradicate various diseases in West Africa, increase inoculation rates, prevent racism from infusing AI. These are actual projects that are making hemp an industrial product for purposes of classification in New York State. These are all projects that the students have worked on. So I do the lecture, but over the course of a couple of days, I also listen to all of these presentations that these student groups make to me and Chris, and try to provide feedback. Sometimes I know people who are working those issues who could be resources, and I connect people in the group to my contacts. And you know, sometimes I say, and I can completely understand this, is, you know, well, one group was working on trying to increase inoculation rates across 20 different diseases, and I said, well, maybe start with one.
Yeah.
You know, maybe start with one, nail the process, you know, make some mistakes, learn from it. And once you feel like it's really airtight, then start applying it more broadly. So it's not necessarily something that, you know, you're in a course, you've got all these other things going on, not necessarily, you've never really been involved in policy, which is why you're taking the class, might not be obvious. But I'm glad when I can sort of help shape to an extent, based on, you know, just what I've experienced, to these projects to make them hopefully more successful.
Yeah, well, that's brilliant. And I couldn't agree with the need more, because I've seen through my career how many people in the STEM fields just don't appreciate the role that policy plays, and they have to be engaged. You really have to have an understanding, at least, how the process works. And then to have someone like yourself come in and talk about how to effectively communicate your work you're doing, that's phenomenal.
Okay.
That's the tip of the hat to you.
Thank you very much. I'm always learning. You know, I definitely don't have all the answers. It's great to interact with these folks and see and appreciate how they think about problems. And I try almost to teach the course like I want them to interact with policymakers or other stakeholders. So the whole connection part, you know, I do things, and at the end of the course, I tell them, look, this is why I did this in the beginning, because I was setting up the stage for this other part that we learned, and that's exactly how I want you to approach, you know, your interactions.
Yeah, that's great advice. So looking back, when you got started in D.C. on Capitol Hill as an unpaid intern for 8 months, sleeping on your sister's sofa.
Exactly.
At any point along that path, can you think of one particular obstacle or challenge that presented itself to you that created a lasting skill set or a memory that you pull on regularly?
Yeah. Well, I don't think of this that regularly, but I can tell you about one indelible situation that occurred not long after I started. I was really new to the legislative route, and a lot of times people on the outside don't appreciate that our system itself is set up to be slow. It's not
by
set
design.
Up, by design, exactly. And some people say, you know, they get frustrated quickly and they just sort of give up. or they think that it's something that they're doing that's not correct, or they need more information. I mean, those things might be right, but go into it with the expectation of this is going to be difficult and it's not necessarily going to happen immediately. It's probably not. So, you know, the reason I mentioned that sort of as a scene setter is because, you know, there are opportunities to input the process, have input in the process various times. If you're on the inside, it can be through amendments, say, right? Mm-hmm. And so I was, Ed had an amendment that I had worked on. So the substance of it was, I don't even actually remember. It might have been an arms control amendment, but I'm not 100% sure. You have to make your case, even as a member of Congress, to the Rules Committee and testify to say why your amendment should even be read and considered for a vote. And, it's one of the kind of procedural issues that isn't talked about a lot outside. So for some reason, I wasn't really clued in to that fact. And I'd worked on the amendment. I'd spent a lot of time. I drafted, got the amendment drafts and everything. And so it wasn't until pretty much right 10 minutes, maybe, before Ed was going to testify at the Rules Committee that he said, you know, where's my statement? Where's the statement that I'm going to have? And so,
whoops.
Because I wasn't even sure that every member had to testify or whatever, I remember vividly sitting outside on the floor of the right outside the Rules Committee hearing room on the floor in that beautiful ornate, Rules Committee right outside the door, which is also beautiful and ornate. And just I was like, look, I've got to do it. I've got to zero in. I got to forget about everything. And I just have to get this in the most concise, most effective way possible that I can do it. Longhand, and for some reason, whenever I write longhand, I write in all caps. I mm-hmm. know I do write cursive, but for some reason, whenever I was on the hill and I was ever had to do this, I was always writing in all caps. And so I did that, and it was basically, as our chief of staff said, around the rim and in. Nope, just barely. I'll never forget that. I guess the lesson is try to think ahead to the extent that you can. And a lot of times that means asking a lot of questions. And, scientists are good at asking questions. But don't be intimidated if you're in a new environment. You want to ask a lot of questions. Don't pretend that you know everything.
Exactly.
And actually, I think it wasn't Corrine's interview on the podcast, but it was Dr. Quinta Warren, who is a petroleum engineer. She had some great advice. It's in another episode. Essentially, what she said is, when you're new, you have that window of opportunity where people don't expect you to know anything. So take advantage of that by asking all questions and trying to really soak up. No question is a foolish question, and that will help you get you up to speed, get you up the learning curve much more quickly.
Yeah, that's something that resonates quite well with me, because I used to always tell all of my staff and visiting faculty members, scientists, I said, look, you can't know everything. They don't expect you to know everything. But if you're presented with a question that you're not sure of the answer, it's better to say, you know what, I don't think I know the answer to that right now, but I'll be happy to get back to you, provide the information later. Because, one, you're being an honest broker, but two, you're creating an instant opportunity to continue
exactly.
the dialogue and have a second conversation.
Right.
And that's priceless.
Right. So true. And I hadn't even thought of that second piece. It's like, so please ask me as many questions as I don't know as possible. But that's really great. I love that. It is so true.
Yeah. Well, Mark, I want to thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us here on Any Proof Politics. I think it's fascinating what you're doing and a very needed niche to advocacy here in town. Keep it up. All the best to you on that. And just remember, no matter what you think about the current state of politics in Washington, whether you think the glass is half full or half empty, there's plenty of room to fill your drink. Cheers.
Cheers.
All right.
All right, that was beautiful.
Thank you, sir.
I love it.
This is Peter.
And this is Tom.
We want to tell you guys a little bit about our podcast. Tom and I met in college, became best friends, and then teachers almost 20 years ago. Sometimes school just does not allow us to elaborate on the topics that we find interesting, like the real shark attacks that inspired the movie Jaws, or the real historical context to Indiana Jones artifacts. Where does cereal come from? Or are zombies real? Does Ben Franklin really deserve to be on a $100 bill? On our podcast, just like in our class, there are no stupid questions.
Just two friends having lighthearted conversation about history, pop culture, and the context of current events.
Listen to History Teachers Talking Podcast from Evergreen Network, anywhere you get your podcasts.